Hello. Welcome to another podcast presented by the Georgia Center for the Book at the DeKalb County Public Library. This podcast from our Festival of Writers brings the world's top authors to the library and the library to you.
Patty Dye is an internationally known blogger. Her new book, Life is a Verb, is drawn from a blog she created after the death of her father from cancer. Given only 37 days of life after his diagnosis, her father's death prompted her to wonder what she would do with her life in that short time. Today's podcast episode features a recording of Patty Dye reading at the Decatur Library on March 30th, 2009.
Had a fantastic dinner with people who evidently, are they here? Where am I? There I go. With a book club, and now I'm in a chocolate coma. A complete and total coma. Can you hear me? Can everybody hear me? I'm a little discombobulated because I left my book, the book that opens neatly to every page I want to read, at my home in Asheville, North Carolina. So I may be flipping through the book a little bit more than I normally would tonight, but it's a pleasure to be here. I will spend about 40 minutes or so talking about this book, reading a couple of things from the book. I'd love to take questions if you have questions at that point, and then I'll end with a short story. I asked for a clock. Now I have a very large clock in the back. I'm the only person, well, maybe there are other people in the crowd who gave birth and got bifocals in the same year. So I have a 16-year-old and a 5-year-old because evidently every 11 years I give birth whether I really need to or not. So talk to me in 6 more years, though actually it would be such a miracle it would be on the front of the New York Times if that actually happened. So it's a pleasure to be here. You know, somebody said at this book club we had a fabulous dinner just to talk about the book a little bit. And Joe had said about an inspirational book. I'm a literature major from graduate school, and I had to recoil from the very idea that I had written a self-help book. And somebody had written in a review that it wasn't so much a self-help book as a soul-help book. So I hope that that's more true, actually, than a self-help book. Though I have heard from people around the world, an overwhelming number of people from different places who've said that they had recognized themselves in these stories, that they had seen themselves in these stories. Actually, the last time I drove to Atlanta, I stopped because I figured I must be lost. I stopped at the Georgia Welcome Center, and I got an email from a woman who said, "I have your book in my pocketbook. I carry it with me everywhere I go. I'm at my beauty shop, and I'm reading or rereading parts of the book." And she was writing from Munich, which was fantastic. So a number of people have said, you know, I don't want to read a book about dying. The premise, as you've been told, is that my stepfather in October of 2003 was diagnosed with lung cancer, and he died 37 days later. I think certainly facing that kind of death and helping him through that transition was eye-opening for me. My dad had died when I was young. I was in college, and he was young. He was 53 years old, which looked younger and younger every day, as you can imagine. But this was the first time I had participated in a death, and it's an awe-inspiring, awkward, horrible, enlightening, great gift in many ways. And those 37 days actually didn't teach me so much about dying as they taught me about living. And so this is a book about living. I'm going to start with something that I think sets the stage for what I focused on in this book, which are very small things. Oprah Winfrey once documented the last days of a young mother dying of cancer who used her final months to make videotape messages for her young children, leaving behind words of wisdom about living, about falling in love, doing laundry, writing thank you notes, steaming artichokes, creating in the process a primer about how to navigate the big and little things of life, which I've come to realize I've been unconsciously doing for my daughters with my blog, 37 Days, and now this book. She and her husband took their children to Disney World and beyond during those final months, anxious to imprint the experiences in the children's minds for all time, knowing she wouldn't be with them long. After the young mother died, Oprah invited her family back to the show, thinking they would comment about the amazing trips they made together. Oprah asked the children about their best memories of their mother. The little girl quietly responded, and it was a response that has stayed with me. I remember once when my mom asked me to get her a bowl of Cheerios, and we ate them together. It isn't the big things, it's those little ones. So this idea of looking at the little tiny things of life, I knew at the end of this 37 days with my stepfather that I wanted to ask myself one question every day when I woke up. And that question was, what would I be doing today if I only had 37 days to live? My friends, this is a tough question because the laundry still needs to be washed. The lunches still need to be packed. And I think we begin to believe in some way that if we were facing the end of our lives, as we all are, but we somehow have short-term memory loss about this idea every day, that we would forego all those mundane things of life and that we would do big things. And I think the story of the Cheerios is actually the biggest lesson that I have had. It isn't those big things. It's the little ones. So these stories were meditations, really, on my life, because I knew that my answer to the question of my last 37 days would be that I would write like hell. I would sit and I would write every story I could think of to tell my two girls, because I knew that I wanted to leave behind not a set of grapefruit spoons or jewelry, though I'm sure they'll be struggling to figure out who gets the grapefruit spoons. That's probably high on their list. But I really wanted to leave behind my stories, because we are made up of stories. That's actually all that we are made up of. So let me give you an idea of why, in fact, I wanted to and decided I wanted to leave behind stories. This is a story in a chapter called Right to Remember. My sissy was a proud woman, always immaculately dressed, coiffed, and with a beautiful coral ring perched high in a golden filigree throne on her right hand. She seemed like royalty to me. My mother's sister, older than Mama by 17 years, she raised my mother as her own after their mother died too young. A furniture store owner's wife, Sissy attended to every detail of showroom beauty with the sensibility of a small-town decorator with a subscription to House Beautiful. Plastic rings of fruit engulfing large candles under glass and light-imbued pastoral landscapes the exact length of sofas. Henry Don and Drexel Furniture Companies awarded them both a dozen Christian tours around the world. So Sissy had adventures from which I was the awestruck recipient of treasures like grass skirts and plastic leis. My first introduction to the world outside. As she slid into Alzheimer's, Sissy tried fearfully to cling to her regal self. It was that middle state that fascinated, frightened, and horrified me, that knowing while sliding. A few years before she fell irretrievably into herself, I visited, walking into her small kitchen. I was immobilized by dozens of calendars on the door to the basement, the refrigerator, the painted cabinets above the sink. Every available surface was covered with a calendar, from large pictorial versions to those little tear-off paper ones that insurance agents give away. On each was a tumbled nest of dark black lines across the squares of days past, a furious marking, a heavy series of X's across the blocks, the unique and horrible signature of a woman desperately trying to keep track of where she was in time, knowing that she didn't know and couldn't remember, creating strategies for tracking, for knowing, for pretending to know, for convincing herself and others that she did know, for saving face, but she didn't know. As soon as she turned away from each calendar, the day fell from her mind, a problem she solved by ensuring that in every direction her head could turn, there she would find solace, the date, that very one. The person who could help best was gone. When his Alzheimer's turned his generous sweetness mean, her husband and my papa had been taken away to play with an Elmo doll at Autumn Care Rest Home. We took the Morganton News Herald to her daily, believing contact with the outside world would help in some way. Puzzled at the untouched piles we found around the house, we finally understood there was one newspaper next to her bed that she read and reread dozens of times each day, week after week, month after month. And until we took the battery from her car while she slept, she drove slowly each day the 3 blocks to the Winn-Dixie, where she had shopped for decades, and bought her daily Hellman's mayonnaise and toothpicks. Watchful teenage bag boys surreptitiously trailed her slow, queenly processional back home in their own cars, guiding her gently back to her rose bushes and calendars when she got lost. In her bedroom were post-it notes, hundreds of them, many with the same information repeated over and over again. 23 1-inch by 1-inch yellow post-it notes perched precariously on the phone alone with my mother's phone number and the beautician's. We knew she had lost the battle when she started wearing only sweatpants with elastic waists, and most importantly, when she stopped getting her hair done. I'll take a moment to tell you one of the most moving emails that I got was from a woman in Europe somewhere who said after she read this story, she said, I realized as I read this story that I've been wearing only sweatpants and I can't remember the last time I got my hair done. So she made herself an appointment. And then one weekend, when my older daughter visited my mother and stepfather, they took her to see Sweet Sissy, as Emma called her. It was on that visit they realized Sissy had finally left for good. Sitting proudly in a straight chair in the living room, she had, it quickly became obvious, sat there for days. A phone next to her, not even able to move, even to go to the bathroom, unable to call for help, since it wasn't the phone with the post-it notes. Covered in her own excrement, she did what she had always done when greeting guests as they entered the room. She briefly touched her now shaky and liver-spotted hand to her hair as if to adjust the curls. She was lifted gently from the chair, her hair carefully brushed, and then swept away in an ambulance, never to return home. It is among the worst ways to die, uncoiffed, unremembering, and not yet dead. Ensconced at the Autumn Care Rest Home, she even began forgetting to chew. Like Sissy, we are all only one step away from losing the stories of our lives. I write to remember. It is a strategy not unlike the multitude of calendars and post-it notes. It is also a strategy for learning and for determining who and what we are and who and what we yearn to be. So this idea of us being made up of stories and always being in danger of losing our stories was really compelling to me. So I started to write. As I told the group over dinner, I had been doing a big consulting job with a major company that ended, which seemed like the end of the world. There's no money. It was the greatest gift I ever got because I started sitting down every morning and writing for 8 hours. About 6 months into it, I must say, my husband said, "How's your vacation going?" Very well, thank you. So I started writing down these stories, and I sent them the first stories to 12 friends because I'm not the most disciplined person in the world, as my family would tell you. I'm not the most disciplined person in the world, so I sent it to 12 friends and said, "I don't care if you read these stories. I don't want you to comment, feel compelled to say they're brilliant. I don't care what you do with them, but if you don't get them on Monday, just write me and say, where are they?" And so they did, and they started sending these stories to other people and other people. And within 6 months, there were 20,000 people subscribed to this blog. Now, I would love to think it's because my stories are so fascinating, but I think it's an internal human desire that we have to have our lives have more meaning, to leave something behind. And I think the things that we leave behind are actually our stories. What came to me as I began to write was an understanding that there's a different way to be, to get out of the sort of power suit, traveling, cosmopolitan, and to see something that is right in front of me when I'm actually at home. That there might actually be a different way of being. Madison, Wisconsin, I visited as part of the book tour, and the woman who hosted me said to me, you know, I know you probably don't want to do this, but I go every Friday afternoon to sing Shabbat at a Jewish senior citizen home, and I'd love for you to go with me if you want to go, but please don't feel like you have to. And I thought, this is fantastic. So off we go. This group of 40 or 50 very old people singing these ritual songs was so moving to me. We have an innate need and desire for that kind of rootedness in ritual. The person who spoke, the thing that she said really stuck with me. We were in the Jewish high holiday. She said, we are in the 10 days of awe. And in the 10 days of awe, we remember the things that are extraordinary. When something extraordinary happens for the first time, she said, we call it a miracle. But when it happens over and over again, we just call it ordinary. And so part of my impulse was to regain the extraordinary in the ordinary. Let me give you an example. This is a piece called Say Wow When You See a Bus. There is a pure and shining glory in the world of my toddler daughter, Tess. It is called a bus. A big, big bus, to be exact. For Tess, there is absolutely no greater joy, no surprise more full, no experience more fantastic than the moment of sheer ecstasy and full body wonder when she sees a bus. Like someone with short-term memory loss, each one is her first. Wow, a bus, she says with every fiber of her being, a big, big bus. For someone so small, she has quite the lung power. A voice that carries for some distance, making heads turn in her wake. There's a close second to bus joy when we approach the tunnel. Do you know Asheville? Does anybody know Asheville, the big, big tunnel in Asheville? The big, big tunnel. But even that pales in comparison with the bus. Then, of course, there's the penultimate thrill of the truck, the big, big truck, or the big red fire truck, or the ice cream truck, or the happy truck, or big, huge truck. A very loud announcement made many times each day and complicated only slightly by the fact that every TR in her noisy vocabulary is rendered as an F. We cut quite a figure in the produce aisle or the post office when she hears a great big fire truck go past, announcing it to the surprised masses. Being around her is like getting a PhD in exuberance. Hers is a joy we all know before we divide ourselves and wall off the part we keep to ourselves, the part we hide for fear of ridicule. There's a great story of a man who goes into a kindergarten class and says, how many of you are artists? And every single kid puts their hand up, of course, waving madly. How many of you are singers? Every hand goes up. How many of you are dancers? Every hand. And, of course, by the time we get to high school, he goes into a classroom and says, how many of you are artists? Maybe one hand goes up. So we all know that phenomenon. As I push Tess in her swing, bigger, bigger, she urges. I muse sometimes about what it would be like to approach life as an adult like Tessie does now, boldly marching forward in her days. Wow, a meeting! Looky, an insanely long and completely inane meeting. Yee, a huge parking ticket. A 200-page strategic plan. A report due tomorrow. A mortgage payment. Wow. A dysfunctional boss in a big, big fire truck. So in addition to this sort of exuberance, the other thing that occurred to me was that there might be a different way to engage with other human beings. This is a story called Squeezing Next to Someone, Arm to Arm. It's told by Marion Woodman, actually tells the story of being in India. She's a Jungian analyst and a writer. And this story gets at one of the, there are six lessons that I've sort of learned over these 5 years or so since I've been writing this this work. And this is one about being generous. And that doesn't mean giving money necessarily. It means opening space for other people, being there for other people. During a stay in India, Marion became sick with dysentery and captive in her hotel room for weeks. Finally, desperate to escape the room, she gingerly made her way to the hotel foyer one afternoon to sit and write a letter to her husband. Sitting near the end of a long, empty couch, she began to write. Although there were other seats available, a very large brown woman came and squeezed between Marion and the end of the couch, so close that their arms were touching, so close it made it difficult for Marion to write. Marion scooted away, angry at the invasion of her space. The woman scooted closer, pushing up against her. "Every time I moved, she moved," Marion said, until we ended up at the other end of the couch. Once she stopped moving away, Marion realized what a nice, big, warm arm the woman had. And so they sat, a thin bird of a sickly white woman and a big brown woman, arm to arm. They shared no common language, so they sat in silence. Marion gave in to the broad, warm arm, the presence of the other, and relaxed into her. The next day, she went again to the hotel foyer to write, and again the woman came and silently sat next to her, touching her. And the third day, and the fourth day, and Marion's health improved. This couch dance continued for a week. One day, a man appeared as the two women finished their silent, warm-armed vigil. "You're all right now. My wife won't come back tomorrow," he said to Marion, nodding toward her couch compatriot. "Your wife," she thought to herself, startled. "Why is she here in the first place?" she asked. Marion was unprepared for his quiet, simple answer. "I saw you were dying and sent her to sit with you. I knew the warmth of her body would bring you back to life," he said. It took a moment for the magnitude of his message and the enormity of what these two strangers had done for her to sink in. "She did save my life," Marion said quietly in recounting the story, "that this woman would take the time to sit with me, and, most importantly, that I could receive it. That is relatedness. That is what it means to hold presence for others." My business partner went on a cruise, I don't know if any of you have ever done this, to Alaska to see whales. And he came back and told the story of this incredible moment of anticipation and awe and reverence as they all sat on this promenade deck and waited for whales to do what whales do. What do they do? They come up. Breach, that's the word. To breach. And he said it was palpable, the waiting and the reverence and the sense of awe as they waited for these whales to breach. And his question was really compelling to me when he came home. He said, "Why is it that we reserve that for whales? Why don't we reserve that kind of awe and reverence for human beings, for the people that we meet as we go through our daily lives?" I went on a business trip a couple of years ago that will be known in my life as the business trip from hell. And one reason was the first day of that business trip, I was leaving from D.C. to fly to Miami to give a speech. And I was on a plane that took off from Washington, D.C., and it became very clear very quickly that there was something very wrong with this plane. And in fact, we had suffered a complete hydraulic failure. If you don't know anything about aerodynamics, I'm here to tell you that this is not good news. In fact, it's the worst kind of news. It is the 11 o'clock, I never thought it would end this way kind of news. And we ended up crash landing in Baltimore. And the reason they sent us to Baltimore, it took an hour and a half to get there because when you have no hydraulics, you can't go up and down, you can't land, you can't turn. It was an involved process. They sent us to Baltimore because there was a bigger space to crash. We would find out later. So that's day one of this business trip. And one would think it could only go up from there. But we've been surprised before. So this is day two of that trip. And I'm actually not going home after the speech. I'm going to Parsippany, New Jersey. This is a story called Say Hi to Yaron. A few years ago, I boarded a flight that changed my life. As I boarded that plane, I now know I was walking away from one version of myself and into another. But at the time, it felt like I was just going to Parsippany. I was in no mood for idle chit-chat on the flight. My seatmate had better shut up and get engrossed in an in-flight magazine and all those lovely trinkets in the SkyMall catalog or in some inane movie about the father of the bride or a wedding planner starring Steve Martin or Jennifer Lopez. I just wanted some peace and quiet. It had been a hell of a trip so far, and I was in no mood to go to New Jersey. I just wanted to go home. My seatmate was a very large man, a broad-faced wonder, a man whose belly was not to be contained in a too small t-shirt from the Grand Canyon, but poured over into my space instead, over the armrest and into my air, my real estate, my 12B. That's just great. I put on my power suit mask and opened my book, a volume of poems in their original German by Rilke. I used to keep it in my carry-on bag for just such emergencies. And I don't read German, so that gives you some idea. It stopped people in their tracks, usually. Not this time. Grand Canyon man rifled incessantly through a plastic grocery bag he kept between his feet on the floor, then up in his lap, and then down again. The sound was overwhelming, as if the universe had focused its sound boom on that one piece of plastic, amplifying it beyond all measure. I could hear nothing else. Every movement he made moved me too. I was irritated. Suddenly, without any warning, there was a loud explosion from his lap. The large family-sized bag of pretzels he had burst open was thrust before me. I was shocked into silence, only nodding a fierce no and returning to my Rilke. It grew dark as we passed through clouds. Suddenly, large plastic bag Grand Canyon pretzel man reached up and turned on my light for me, still not speaking. Perhaps he is mute. He looks like a larger-than-normal Aleutian. A giant Aleutian mute. That's just great. I don't want to engage. Can large plastic bag Grand Canyon mute Aleutian pretzel man not understand that? I nodded with a forced grin to acknowledge his gentlemanly intrusion. Then it hit me. I had just given a speech to 12,000 people about not judging people by how they look. I determined between sips of Bloody Mary mix, which was actually a Bloody Mary, but my mother's reading the book, so I said Bloody Mary mix. I determined between sips of Bloody Mary mix to be nicer, to reclaim my humanity, to try, dear sweet God, to restore what little karma I had left. When I saw large plastic bag Grand Canyon mute Aleutian pretzel man taking photos out of the plane window with a disposable Kodak, I made my move. What are you taking photographs of? I asked in that slow, loud, excruciatingly enunciated voice sometimes used for non-English speakers. We don't have rivers this big in Israel, he said slowly in halting English with a beautiful Israeli accent. One of my dearest and wisest friends is from Israel. I turned to face this fabulous voice. Where are you from in Israel? And with that question began a friendship that endures even now, years later. Yaron was a policeman in Netanya, a coastal town in Israel, and he and his police partner had saved their money for 5 years to come on this three-week trip to the United States. But her grandmother had died the week before the trip, and they couldn't get her money back. So Yaron came by himself, and for 3 weeks had probably been the recipient of the same kind of response that I had given him as he traveled around the United States. I've traveled all over the U.S. in these 3 weeks, he told me. I rented a tiny car in Los Angeles and drove to the Grand Canyon. He held his large hands very close together, mimicking how small a steering wheel his budget compact car had. When you stand at the edge of the Grand Canyon, you want to turn to the person next to you and say, "Look, look at that," he said. I didn't have anybody to turn to. I went to Walt Disney World in Florida, and my video camera broke. I couldn't help myself. I started crying in the middle of the street. One of the workers saw me and gave me this little paper camera so I could take pictures while I was there. "But you know," he said, looking straight at me, "it's not the same. When you see a field of wheat blowing in the breeze, it's so much different than just seeing a still picture of the wheat, isn't it?" It occurred to me I was in the presence of someone with a poet's soul all wrapped up in a policeman's body. "Yes," I answered, "it's very different." So we talk all the way to Newark. When we got there, my client had arranged for a car, but the car wasn't there. So it gave us more time to talk. We went into a coffee shop and talked for a couple of hours. He told me about his fiance going to the market 3 days before their wedding and being killed by a truck on the way home. His large sausage fingers moving slowly to just under his eyes, where he held them for a moment to serve as log jams for the tears that had collected. He talked about his part-time design business. "You have to see what I got," he said, digging deeply in one of the bags that surrounded his feet. "It is so beautiful." His broad face lit up at the very thought of it. He rooted around a good while. I asked the manager if I could have one because I had never seen anything like it, he said excitedly. And finally, he sat up again, his large hands dwarfing a Shoney's menu. "Isn't this beautiful?" he asked. "Just look at the color." Yaron was planning to take a city bus when we had landed in Newark to find a cousin he had never met to spend the night. This was his last night in the United States, as it turns out. And I was determined to take him to his cousin's house in a cab and not let him go with all these plastic bags of pretzels on a bunch of city buses. So we went outside, and the first guy in the cab line was a very old man driving a cab, and he said, "You need two cabs. It'll cost you $150. You're going in opposite directions. You need to have two cabs." I said, "The man deserves better. We're going to take him to wherever his cousin is. And then I'll go to Parsippany." We got very lost on the way to his cousin's house, which gave us another couple of hours to talk to each other. And then we started backtracking to Parsippany, a city that I believe the cab driver had never been to. It is now 2 a.m., and we had landed at 6 p.m., and I had forgotten to call my husband. And because I'm from the South, I wanted to call and ask my husband, John, if he could MapQuest where we were in relationship to Parsippany. But I didn't want to say it out loud because that would insult the cab driver, right? So I call John, and I'm on the cell phone in the back whispering fervently, "John, I'm on the New Jersey Turnpike." I'm trying to tell him where I am on the New Jersey. And, of course, he's panicked by this point. And all I hear is, "Have you been kidnapped?" He says, "If you've been kidnapped, say the word umbrella." You don't have that code in your house that you say the word umbrella? If you're in my family, you're in trouble. You say the word umbrella. I'm not sure how that would have come up in conversation. We finally did make it to the hotel. Yaron called the next morning to wish me well in my speech. He calls from Israel every Christmas Eve and names all of Santa's reindeer, even though Santa isn't part of his tradition. He stays up late to call us on New Year's Eve. When he found out that John's grandmother, Nana, was a devout Catholic, he sent holy water from the River Jordan for us to give her. And just so you know, it isn't water from my bathroom, he said. I made a video of me getting it. I made a video of me getting it from the River Jordan. Sure enough, the water arrived with a videotape of him driving and filming at the same time to the River Jordan. He videotaped the River Jordan sign, followed by shaky camera motion, while the video camera was set on a rock and he ran in front of it. And this is my favorite part of the whole story, bending down with a Fanta bottle. Do you know Fanta? Scooping in holy water. So we got a videotape and a Fanta bottle full of muddy water is basically where we're going. What would I have missed if I hadn't said hello to him? So each of the stories I ended with a challenge for my two girls and for me. Say hi to your own. You never know when you might be the highlight in a trip, a needed word, a special kindness. You never know when you might find the friend you've needed or the learning that changes everything for you. This wasn't large plastic bag Grand Canyon Mutilution Pretzel Man. This was a real person with a name and a history and stories that make him laugh and cry. He was a who, not a what, just like me. I'd love to take any questions that you have before I read one or two other pieces. And I know the first question is always tough, so we could start with question number two if you want. Any questions that you have? Yeah. The question was from business literature to business. I was a graduate student. My mother is still wondering when I'm going to teach, graduate in English. And when I moved to Washington, I started working in nonprofit organizations, doing a lot of international work, and was writing some as a part of that. But I wrote two business books, and as I said to the group at dinner, two books that did very well in terms of their contribution to the field. I'm very proud of them. But when the first book, when the first box of books came from the publisher, the first business book, I felt nothing when I opened the box. And I guess just to test that theory again, I did another business book. And I, again, didn't really feel a connection to the work. So this book, when it came from the publisher, was a different story for me because it's written in a voice that is my voice and not the sit up straight, wear the power suit kind of voice. I was at Penland School of Crafts. I don't know if any of you know Penland. And I had to leave from this very artsy, Birkenstock, fantastic place to go do a speech for a big financial company in Texas. So I had brought with me to Penland my power suit. And the contrast was so striking to me that I would leave this place where I felt so comfortable and so in my own skin and go to do something else. And I said to the guy who was at dinner with me, who wished, I'm sure, that he had sat with a potter, for God's sake, as opposed to me, you know, what do you do? And everybody goes, oh, I'm a potter, I'm an iron worker, I'm a management consultant dealing with structural inequality. But I said to him, you know, the thing that bothers me about this is that I feel like somebody else is speaking. You know, I'm standing in front of people giving a speech, but somebody else is speaking. He said, wait right here. He ran off, and I thought he had deserted me. But he came back with a piece of sculpture he had done that was made out of farm implements, recycled farm implements. And it was a torso of a man in a business suit. And his head was made out of farm implements. And in the back of the torso was a little door you could open, and you could turn a crank. And when you turn the crank, the mouth would go like this. I said, yeah, that's it. That's it. So, this is a piece. It's a piece called Save Face for Someone Else. When I was in high school, I had my dream job. Mrs. Barnett, the head librarian at the Morganton Burke Public Library, had watched me grow up there. As a child, I was in the library every Saturday, and every Saturday I checked out the same book, year after year. Up I would walk with that dog-eared book in my arms and put it in the return book slot. I would stand very still and wait until Ruth Setzer, the bony-armed librarian, checked it in, taking out its ink-stained due date card and closing the cover. Without a word, she would extend that impossibly thin, long arm to me with my treasure at the end of it. I would grab it and run back to the children's section until Mama was ready to go. Then, as we readied to leave, I checked it out again and took it back home, where it obviously belonged. One Saturday, Mrs. Barnett summoned me to the circulation desk, a formidable walnut fortress. The other librarians gathered round as she handed in a package to me. "Now," she said sweetly, "we hope you might leave the adventures of Pippi Longstocking here so other children might read it. Here's your very own copy to take home." As an aside, I read this story in the Morganton Burke Public Library recently, and Mrs. Barnett was there. Yeah. As a wildly redheaded and freckled child myself, Pippi was somewhat of a goddess to me, my alter ego, my shero. When I turned 15, Mrs. Barnett offered me a job working at the circulation desk, that great ship I had hovered in front of so many Saturdays as a child. I was ecstatic to be among all those books. I still hear the sound of the wheels on book cart number 2 as I rolled it through the stacks, getting lost in a world in which one tug at a shelf could unravel and reveal so much wonder. It was magical. Until one day when the quiet magic was shattered as a very angry woman slammed a card catalog drawer shut and stomped up to the desk. This was highly unusual in the Morganton Burke Public Library. There didn't seem too awfully much to get angry about. There hadn't been this much activity since a fellow who worked at Hardee's had been caught drinking aftershave in the men's room. "I cannot believe," she hissed, "that this library doesn't have any books about psychology. It's an outrage. How dare you call yourselves a library?" Her voice ricocheted off the reserve shelves. Being the only one at the helm at that moment, it was up to me to respond. Timidly, I did. "I know I've shelved some books about psychology before." "Really?" she interrupted. "There's none in the card catalog. None. Zero. Zip. Ridiculous. Aren't there any grown-ups who work here?" I'd hate to say what I'd say to her now as a great older. "Aren't there any grown-ups who work here? They're in a meeting right now," I whispered, scared, "but I'll help if I can." At that, she stomped her way back to the card catalog, with me trailing meekly the way Pippi never would have done. "Where were you looking?" I asked. "Well, young lady, where on earth do you think I was looking?" she answered as she flung open a card drawer until it nearly fell out. The drawer she had opened was the S drawer. It hit me like a bolt, a heat wave that spread through my face. "Well," I answered very quietly after a moment, "perhaps we should try the alternate spelling." Sometimes that works. And I gently moved her to the P drawer. I don't know how I knew to do that, but even now I'm proud I did. Helping her save face and retain her dignity was important, even though, and maybe especially because, she had been berating me. Decades later, I was in line at the giant food supermarket in Washington, D.C., when a woman ahead of me in line was buying some basic foods, a very few items, including a package of the cheapest, fattiest meat I had ever seen. As the cashier got closer to the end of ringing up her 8 items, the woman kept asking for the subtotal and digging into her small change purse, realizing as the meat made its sad journey up the conveyor belt that she could never afford it. She lacked $1.07. With the saddest eyes I had ever seen, she told the cashier to put it back. I couldn't bear it. "Excuse me, ma'am," I said as I bent down between my cart and the chewing gum display, "you must have dropped this $5 bill. I had read once about a millionaire who gives away money to people in need by pretending to find it on the street as if they dropped it. It is a way for him to give without appearing to be the grand poobah of cash, without taking credit for the gift, without assuming the power that sometimes comes with giving. It puts the impulse for giving and helping where it should be, on the dignity of the receiver. As I end, there's a great quote from Mother Teresa I would leave you with. If we are without peace in the world, it is because we have forgotten that we belong to each other. Thank you so much for being here.
The program you've been listening to featured Patty Dye, an internationally known blogger and author of the new book, Life is a Verb.
This program has been brought to you by the Georgia Center for the Book at the DeKalb County Public Library. You can find out more about the Festival of Writers and these podcasts at our websites, GeorgiaCenterForTheBook.org and DeKalbLibrary.org. Thanks very much for listening.